Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to this, the last episode of Interop Radio live from the expo floor at Interop 2015. We are so glad that you've been able to be with us all week long. You know, we have had a great series of shows, and we've got more great shows coming up on Interop Radio. It's just that, well, they're not going to happen from the expo floor because in just about 59 minutes, the expo floor at Interop 2015 is going to come to a close. Now, we've got some great guests here on Interop Radio, Interop Live today. And to get started, I've got one of my favorite guests. Have Dave Wagner, the executive editor for online community and IT life at Information Week. Dave, welcome to Interop Radio.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
So, since the last time we talked here on Interop Radio, you've been wandering around, seeing things, talking to people. How has Interop been for you?
Well, really exciting, except I've basically spent it all in about three rooms. One of the funny things about following a single track is that a lot of those events tend to happen in the same room. So I spent most of my day yesterday in Breakers F. So call out to my peeps in Breakers F.
Now, you were following the leadership track, is that correct? So,
yeah.
So what kind of leadership issues were you hearing people talk about in the conference?
What was amazing to me is that there was a lot of synergy. There were a lot of people who had never met, maybe they'd met, but they did not pre-plan their meetings around each other, who were all basically glomming onto the same idea, which is that we have not been treating technology as a human thing enough. We've been treating our teams very much like our technology, something we could take advantage of, something that we didn't really have to pay that much attention to. And there's been a real backlash to that. We spent a lot of time talking yesterday about if technology is not about people, then it's not really very useful.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear you talk about that, because I know one of the things that I've talked with the leader of the Interop Net about, Glenn Evans, who's the, his official title is chief architect, but I'd say he's also the chief cat herder. And he's happy to say that of the two sides of that equation, the technology and the people, the technology is easy. The people is where he really has to pay some attention to make sure that everything works as well as it does here within the InteropNet team.
Right. I can absolutely believe that. I've heard four different stories of transformation that CIOs have done this week. And all of them started by saying that they inherited organizations where the technology wasn't working. There was a lot of downtime. But before they fixed that, they had to fix what one of the CIOs called working wounded. He had people who had been so beaten up by other managers and the crisis and the downtime that they just weren't engaged anymore. And so he spent a huge amount of time working that out, because, as he said, you need to give your employees the gift of accomplishment, which was a phrase I really appreciated. Everybody comes to work wanting to get something done. If you don't get something done, it doesn't feel worthwhile at all. So what he said about measuring those changes to the network, mostly by measuring the changes for the people. And he saw that the two went hand in hand.
Very good. I'm sorry about the little delay there. We've got our next guest coming into the studio and getting him set. Dave, now, it's interesting because I think a lot of people don't associate interop with that people side of things. From what you saw and heard, do you think that the people side of the equation is one that we're going to be hearing more about within the networking community in general and interop specifically?
Oh, absolutely. One of the morning sessions today was so well attended that 5 minutes before it was supposed to start, they were turning people away because the fire marshal was going to complain about any more people in the room. And so even though I have a press pass and I was supposed to be at the event, it wouldn't let me in either. And when everybody left that session, it was like a clown car. I never knew so many people could fit in that room. All week, leadership has been one of the most well-attended tracks here. So I think it's really becoming an issue.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But in the meantime, we're going to talk about still another aspect of the networking business. We have one of the speakers from the Interop conference here in the booth. We've had a number of technology leaders, and here we're going to be talking with someone coming at things from the legal side of the world. We have David Adler of the Adler Law Group joining us. David, I want to ask you to get a little bit closer to that microphone. You want to be kind of uncomfortably close to the mic. And now that you're there, welcome to Interop Radio.
Well, hi, Curtis. Thanks for having me.
Now, David, we got in touch with one another via Twitter. We were out there on the social media things. Talk to me a little bit about what you were here talking about at Interop.
Well, yeah, thank you. My session is very interesting to me, and I hope that it's very interesting to the attendees as well. I'll be talking about the intersection of mobile advertising and privacy and the increasingly difficult situation for any player in the mobile advertising ecosystem to get consent from the users, the app users themselves, around the information that they're sharing.
You know, that's fascinating because privacy is one of the two big areas that often get sort of jammed together, but it's important to remember that they're two distinct things. We tend to talk about privacy and security together, and it's one thing, I think, to talk about how we're going to protect the data from our customers, our partners, our employees, all that, once we have it. But privacy is often an issue about whether we should be gathering that information to begin with. Is that really one of the issues that you deal with?
I think that's absolutely correct. I think people do oftentimes confuse privacy with security. And like you said, security is about how we protect the data we have. And privacy is really about, should we be collecting that data in the first place? And once we have collected it, do we have any obligations with respect to how we share that data?
Well, David, I ran a session earlier this week on data analytics, and I had a lot of CIOs and analytics professionals in the room, and they're under an enormous amount of pressure, particularly from their CMOs and CEOs, to gather more and more customer data, and so that data can be turned into some sort of ROI around their analytics. How do you reconcile that pressure to gather that data to do what you're doing, but also serve the customer's privacy? Where do we learn to draw the line?
I think the line may be drawn for the C-suite by the regulators, to be honest. I am all for gathering a large amount of data, as much data as needed, to improve the customer experience, to improve customer service, to improve the products that are made available to customers. I think the key is to understand really how to educate the customer about the information that they're giving up. And what I see in the mobile advertising space is simply a lack of understanding of information that's being shared. And principally, it's around geolocation. Geolocation is sort of the hot button issue right now. It's squarely in the crosshairs of the FTC. The FCC has started to look at privacy and geolocation data. There's a number of federal laws that are currently in bill status that are addressing the gathering of geolocation data as part of the larger gathering of data that's necessary to drive these analytics. And I think for companies that are looking to monetize that data, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's really how what they're doing with that, how it's being shared with third parties, and whether the subject of that data, the person whose data is being gathered, really understands what's being shared, how far afield that is going, and what else is being done with it.
Right. Well, it's interesting because you have the government regulating the amount that telecoms and advertisers can keep data, while at the exact same time the NSA is using that data that's being collected to do all sorts of things that may or may not even be legal. How are they even? Are they going to find a way to accidentally regulate themselves out of the intelligence business? Or
I'm sure the government will always find a way to give themselves a carve out, and I think that also confuses some of the dialogue because people have heard over the last year about the amount of government surveillance that is going on and the government monitoring of all these electronic communications, and that's not the same thing as the privacy that I'm talking about in my presentation today. My focus is really more on consumer privacy vis-a-vis businesses in you know, the commercial space. But I agree that the, you know, how the government is positioning itself in that sort of surveillance and monitoring role is going to be very telling in terms of how strong or how weak some of this legislation ends up being.
You know, one of the things that I find interesting in the conversation around privacy is that it seems to me that it is evolving somewhat. I heard an interview a couple of months back with Alan Dershowitz, who was talking about notions of the legal ideas of privacy. And he said that one of the things that concerns him is that some definitions might be changing because of all the sharing that goes on in applications like Facebook and Twitter. Because he used a term that I think is unfamiliar to a lot of people, and that's the reasonable man. You know, would a reasonable person have an expectation of privacy in a given situation? And one of his concerns is that with the increased sharing of everything, the expectation of privacy is changing. Is that something that you've seen as well? And is it something that concerns you when you're talking to both companies and individuals?
Well, to answer your first question, yes, it is something that I have seen. I think the online platforms, the social media platforms, have enabled an enormous amount of sharing. And I think a lot of the sharing goes on without people fully understanding what they're sharing and the degree to which it's being shared. At the same time, I think that norms are changing, and it's somewhat generational. So, you know, people like to talk about millennials, and they like to talk about digital natives. So there is a generation of people who are growing up with an always-on existence. For example, my children think that the internet has always existed. It just is. And it's something you go on and you use. And they don't realize that in doing some of these things, it's a departure from the way things used to be done. So their expectations of privacy, their expectations of what would be considered reasonable might be different than yours or mine.
Mark Zuckerberg actually said privacy is dead, right? And what's interesting about it, I think, is when anybody says X is dead, it's the quickest way to bring it back to life.
Absolutely. If you look at what's going on from the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, right now, they are really scrutinizing companies' privacy practices, especially in the online space, and they are making very big examples out of companies that don't do it properly and mislead people. And I think eventually the law and hopefully public perception is going to catch up with what technology enables people to do, because right now technology is ahead of the law and technology is ahead of public perception of what's possible. And as these cases come up and as they gain more notoriety and as major, you know, leaders like Zuckerberg say things like privacy is dead, it's going to improve the discussion.
Right. Well, here's a question. When I download an app from an app store, it gives me a set of permissions I have to agree to, right? Now, I'll admit some apps are better than others about the kinds of things they're, how they describe what they're going to do, what they really tell me versus what they do. But in a lot of ways, this, to me, gives me the freedom as a consumer to make a decision. It sounds like the federal government doesn't think that's enough. Do you think that's enough? Do you think the technology side can police this on our own? Or do we actually need regulation to make this work?
I don't like to see regulation, unnecessary regulation. I really do believe that a free market will establish the best norms for everybody. That being said, I don't think that consumers today are capable of understanding what they're consenting to. When you get a pop-up notification on your handheld device that says, we would like to share your location information, what they don't tell you is that they might be sharing the GPS coordinates that come from the GPS feature in your phone. They may be sharing the location information from your Wi-Fi hotspot connections. They may be sharing location information that is in the EXIF files, your pictures. So location information can be found in many different areas of the mobile phone. And it's not so much the information as the context around it. And this is really where the FTC is starting to focus. It's not just about sharing location or sharing data. It's also about the context in which this information is being shared. And I think that unless the industry takes a very, very proactive approach, which they are unlikely to do for many different reasons, the FTC and other regulators may step in and set a privacy norm. With all that being said, my biggest fear is that consumers are simply incapable of understanding what is being shared in a way that allows them to give meaningful consent. In order for them to give meaningful consent, they would literally have to get 100 of these pop-up windows consenting to every single type of information being collected and every single use for which it might be shared. And they're just not going to do that.
Now, let me ask a question on that informed consent piece of it. Do you think that the lack of informed consent comes because companies intentionally make it difficult to understand what is being agreed to, or is it just the nature of the technology being so complex that companies could be absolutely clear and it would still be very difficult?
I think it's a combination of factors. I don't think that companies are intentionally trying to obfuscate the issue. I think if you look at privacy disclosures, they try to be pretty open about what they're collecting, what they're doing with it. But if you can make it past the second or third sentence, you know, you're a unique individual, right? I mean, I get paid to read and write those things. 99.9% of the consumers out there are never going to read them. So even if they did read them, which they don't, would they understand what they're reading? And I question whether they can, and I think that in and of itself is part of the problem. And what it has led to is sort of this just blind acceptance. In other words, I just want to use this app, so I'm just going to agree to this, and I will just assume a benevolence on the part of the company that they're not going to do anything that's really going to harm me.
Well, in the realm of global commerce, it's obvious that, for example, the U.S. has taken a rather different approach to privacy than the EU has taken. I think the most notable of those is the EU's right to be forgotten that has gotten so much press. Do you think that what ultimately is needed is some sort of global framework for privacy? And is such a thing even meaningfully possible given all of the different understandings of privacy and all the different economies around the world?
I think a global privacy standard would be exceptionally hard to come to. I think you have to look at so many different factors. Every geography, every country has different norms. They have different requirements, and they have different understandings of what privacy even means. I read an interesting article just this week about the difference between you know, what goes on in the U.S. and, let's say, what goes on in the UAE, for example. In the U.S., there was a recent case involving somebody who went onto social media and was quite vocal about his, you know, unhappiness with an employer. He got fired. The NLRB said, well, you have to reinstate that guy. He's a right to complain. In the UAE, a worker had gone on vacation. While he was on vacation, he tweeted something about how he was unhappy at work. He came home to face criminal fines and arrest for complaining about his workplace. So, I mean, that's a huge difference in perspective and perception of these things, number one. Number two is, you know, you mentioned the EU has the EU Privacy Directive, and the understanding of privacy in the European Union is very different than in the United States, where we have a very ad hoc approach. Privacy is looked at primarily on an industry-by-industry standpoint, and they're different, and they don't always integrate well. So, for example, you have HIPAA that governs healthcare information. You have the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act that regulates financial information. Okay, so you have sort of a piecemeal approach, even in the United States. And to harmonize that with the rest of the world, good luck.
Outstanding. Well, David, I'm afraid we've come to the end of this segment. Can you remind everyone when and where you're talking here at Interop today?
I'm talking today at 4 o'clock, and I don't remember the name of the room. It's Laguna J&K, I believe. It's in the main hallway with most of the presentations, and it's near the Speaker Resource Center.
Outstanding. Well, if you're listening to this here at Interop, definitely plan to check that out. And, David, you've been a great guest. This is your first time here on Interop Radio, and we look forward to having you as a guest again in the future. You've got a wealth of things to talk about. We would love to get some more of that knowledge. Speaking of that, you and I got together on Twitter. Is that the best way for people to follow your thinking, or are there other ways for them to keep up with your thoughts on these topics?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I am on Twitter. It's at Adler Law. I'm on LinkedIn. It's Adler Law. I'm on Facebook. It's Adler Law. And I have a blog. It's adlerlaw.wordpress.com. The blog is really the best place to find what I'm thinking about. There's also a way to sign up for my monthly newsletter, where I talk about a lot of the subjects that affect IT professionals.
Well, thank you very much for taking time out of a busy schedule to be with us today. We will look forward to next time.
Great. Thank you very much.
That was David Adler of the Adler Law Group talking with us about IT law, something he's going to be talking about here at the Interop Conference in just a short while. We're going to take just a brief break, but we'll be right back with you. You don't go away. We'll be back with another great guest in just about 15 seconds. And we're back here at Interop Radio, once again, live from the expo floor here at Interop 2015. You know, there are only about 35 minutes left in the expo floor time. We see people walking around, kind of doing their last sweeps through the aisles, having those last conversations with vendors. And interestingly enough, you know, you've heard us talk all week long about how important the human-to-human contact is at Interop, this is the time of the show when it's very interesting to watch the staff at the various booths go around and talk to one another. This is kind of the time when they can share stories about what the show has been like, when they can get information to see if partnerships are available. There's a lot of interchange that goes on even among what should be competitors out there on the show floor. And I think that speaks to just what a special event Interop is. That feeling of sharing is right there. Well, speaking of special here at Interop, we've got a very special guest. Now, I have to give this gentleman a little bit of a problem because I've tried to have him on twice so far this week, and he has avoided me both times, but he couldn't get away this time. We've got Jeff Enters, who is the chief of everything architectural at HP's Global Services Group. Jeff, welcome to Interop Radio.
Excellent. Thank you, Curtis. Yeah, it's a technology consulting organization, but yes, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, close enough.
Now, Jeff, first of all, tell us a little bit about what you and your group have been doing here as part of the InteropNet, and are you're also taking part in SDN Labs, aren't you?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, so thanks again for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And some schedule conflicts there early, but glad we were able to make it work out. So, yeah, so as part of my group here with the HP organization, we've got a couple different areas that we're participating in. One, as you mentioned, is the InteropNet Network, which is actually our eighth year participating in that side of the house. And then we are also doing SDN Labs.
Well, now, when people think about HP and networking, I think their first thought might be, well, obviously, Jeff has brought a bunch of switches in to be part of the network, but that's not really what's defining your presence here. Can you tell us what you're doing as part of the InteropNet?
Yeah, sure, you bet. So we, as I mentioned, we've been doing this for a little while, and we've had a number of different areas that we've participated in throughout the show and providing some of the switching at the show floor. But we've moved more of the stuff that we're helping out with as part of this overall InteropNet program and all the different vendors that come together and volunteers that come together to make it happen. And so we've moved a lot of our help is up in the data centers, the three data centers that we have across the country, and then our warehouse out in California where we call it, it's our hot stage event where we get ready for the show. So we have switching, routing, IPSs, and then we also have some of our blade servers up in those data centers to help provide services and connectivity for show attendees and for show management and for us in the NOC.
Well, now, I'm reasonably sure that there are a lot of people who think about Interop and who actually come to Interop who have no idea that there are these colos in the three different locations. I mean, Interop is right here. It's in the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. Why do we need colos? What's going on up there?
Very good question. So back in the day, probably 3-4 years ago at least, we used to go into these convention centers and we'd have DS3s or something along that lines, or even back in the day, T1s, ordered up and then get that connectivity and then verify that works. And that was just basic internet connectivity. And so we'd have to bring, I think we were probably in the neighborhood of 10-ish racks that we would have to bring just for the core of the network, let alone everything that's distributed throughout the show. So the great thing was through the partnership with CenturyLink, providing these data centers, we are now able to take a lot of the services that we offer to, again, show management and show attendees and vendors and everybody else here at the show and the stuff that we need to make the network run, we're able to move that up into those data centers, have these pipes here, have all our IP addresses already set. So when we come in, we went from probably a few days it would take us to get everything turned up to we usually have connectivity within a matter of hours.
Now, you mentioned the various services that are offered. I would be willing to bet that a lot of people who are here at Interop are going, I've got a wireless connection. What's he talking about, services?
Yeah, so we've got a lot of it's, no question, a good majority of what we have up there is providing services for operating the network, right? So some of the DNS and DHCP, things like that are up there, firewalling, tracing, monitoring, all of those kind of services. So all these vendors that come in to make this network happen, they're allowed to put stuff up in those data centers to help them manage the network that's then providing this basic connectivity down here at the show. So, yeah, it's good.
The integration really is a key portion of all this, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to bring a bunch of vendors together, but it's really quite something else to be able to say we're going to make sure that each of those vendors is able to work to their best advantage in the network. How difficult is it to make sure that all of the pieces are integrated? Is Interop a simple integration job, or is it on the complex side of the scale?
Interesting question, because I think that we've historically we've tried to make the network really cool, right? And so we've done a lot of the latest, greatest technologies and really pushed limits, and you know, whether it's 100 gig or SPB or all these different kind of things that we've done. And well, it was great, and it was a great way to demonstrate those technologies and products in a production environment. We've now actually kind of flipped the coin a little bit, and we've started to actually simplify things so that we can provide that basic connectivity, but then be able to do some additional things on top of that, right? So have that underlying foundation, and then be able to put things on it like SDN and things like that.
You know what I'd really love to see you try to do? I'd like to have you dare yourself to see the oldest piece of legacy equipment that you could throw into the middle of an Interop network.
And see it work.
Yeah, and see if you could make it work. Not only because I think it'd be fun, but because I know right now we have an awful lot of network architects and engineers who are struggling with legacy equipment of one sort or another.
Yeah. No, it's funny you mention that, because so as I mentioned, we've been doing this for a long time, right? And so when we started doing some of the data center stuff, which was, at least 5 years ago probably now, and I'm going to think about that, because I put some switches up in there. It was right around the time of the 3Com acquisition. I used some of the switches I had from back in the 3Com days, actually, that I put up in the data center, and so they've been there. And then last year we decided, you know what, let's see what we can do with SDN. Let's at least start to lay some foundations for SDN in future shows where we can capitalize on SDN. We can't break what we've got today. We can't re-architect what we have today, but maybe we can do a little bit. And with a simple code upgrade on these switches that are up in those data centers, code upgrade, turn on OpenFlow with a few commands, and those switches are now OpenFlow capable, and we can do what we want with them from an SDN perspective. So, yeah, it's a very good point. So we actually do have some fairly old equipment that's out there. We can't just afford to replace it every year. So sometimes as new vendors come in, yeah, you're going to get some of the latest, greatest gear, but some of the stuff we have out there has been around for a while.
You know, you've mentioned the SDN portion a couple of times, and one of the conversations that I've had with a number of people here at Interop now revolves around the cases where SDN is appropriate. And you get a lot of people who have differing opinions. You hear some people who say, well, only the big ISPs need to worry about SDN, or only one of the big service providers of another sort. You know, only a multinational enterprise needs to worry about SDN. From where you sit, is InteropNet the kind of network that could actually benefit from SDN?
Yeah, I think there's actually, that's what I'm hearing a lot too, as I'm out here talking to people during the show, is this, you know, there's some misconception behind it right now that either it's only for the really big guys, or it's about turning off my traditional networking and turning on SDN. And that's just really not the case, right? I think SDN can play in a number of different environments. I think you have to have make sure you got the right business justification for it. Make sure you're tying it back to some either business justification or something that's going to help the overall IT organization. Don't do technology just for technology, but I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and I think it's less risk than people might think. Some of the applications that we have out here this week are really innovative. I mean, they're just it's being able to do things with networking that you've never been able to do in the 30 years that I've been doing networking. You know, so.
Well, one of the other things, and I know this is something that we've been dealing with in the SDN lab a lot over the past few days. Interop got its start talking about interoperability, and for most of what I'm going to call classic networking, interoperability is now pretty much a given. I mean, you can talk from one switch to another without thinking about it.
Yep.
SDN isn't that way. And so how far do you think we are from being able to have something that looks like reasonable interoperability. You were talking about the legacy equipment that a lot of people still have to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And yet one of the other criticisms that we hear about SDN right now is that it must be a complete forklift upgrade, that essentially you have to plow and create a green field or it's not worth dealing with. And if that's so, it's really going to limit the market for SDN out there.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to help people understand as we've been out here at the show, is it isn't about forklift upgrades. Like I mentioned, we've got these three data centers. There's a router in each data center. They're doing BGP. They're doing OSPF. They're doing all the things that we've been doing for years. And then I put one controller out in California, and it's through an open flow to our DMZ switches in each colo. So it's literally a few switches, two switches basically in each data center. There's no open flow on the routers or anything like that. We didn't change the overall architecture. We didn't even put it on all the VLANs on those switches in those data centers, right? We just put it on a few of them. Some we felt were a little bit more that either we didn't need it or, you know, it could feasibly introduce some risk, so we just didn't put it there. But we've got the benefit of it for up there is from a security perspective and a visibility perspective. That's absolutely where we turn it on, in just those very pinpoint locations. So helping people understand that, I think two things. One, it can be a very surgical enablement of SDN, right? So you can put it on literally one VLAN, which can be attached to one port if you really wanted to, right? You don't have to blanket everywhere. It doesn't require a reboot of the switch unless you need to upgrade maybe to get there. But, you know, so there's that part of it. And then there's that, you know, that traditional networking will still happen. The packet will come in, depending on how the individual vendors implement OpenFlow. We're doing OpenFlow 1.3, and we're using something called forward normal at the end. So the packet comes in, it either matches a rule in that table, and we've just got a couple written in there right now to do some basic protection stuff, and then at the end of the table it says forward normal. So at an ASIC level, wire speed, runs to that table, gets done with the OpenFlow table, and then passes on its normal merry way, the way we've been doing it for the past how many years, right? So it's not about turning anything off and turning this on. And from a risk standpoint, worst case scenario, a lot of people get panicked about, well, if my controller, how can you have a controller in Newark, New Jersey, or a controller in San Francisco and a switch in Newark, New Jersey? That's crazy. If something happens, it breaks. It's like, okay, if it breaks, I don't get this new feature that I haven't been able to do for the last 30 years, but I'm still going to function. My network's still going to run, right? So in our case, it's picking off DNS packets and checking for malware, right? See if they're going to malicious sites. Well, if we lose that capability at an access layer, we still have the IPSs and stuff, but at the access layer of the network, if we lose that capability, hopefully for not very long, if we could rebuild a VM or something like that, but if we lose that for a short period of time, everything else still works. You know, they still go through their DNS lookups, everything else. We lose that little bit of extra functionality that we've gotten by this. So
you're not talking about something where what you lose is complete connectivity.
It's
you're losing perhaps some of the speed, some of the features, but not basic connectivity.
Yeah, you're not even losing any speed, right? I mean, it's literally, you know, in this case, we do that DNS look, that inspection. We're not responding to OpenFlow or the controller. It's not responding to the DNS packet. It's just looking to see if it's going to a bad place in this scenario. So it's not about turning anything off and on. So.
Now, one of the questions I have to ask, because you were talking about an OpenFlow version, mm-hmm. and I know that a lot of different companies are working and doing kind of their own thing around OpenFlow. Is there any danger in your mind that OpenFlow could become to SDN what Android has become to mobile devices, where there are about 17,000 different versions, each of which is slightly incompatible with the others?
Right.
And ultimately, you know, we suffer from an overwhelming number of choices, and this actually becomes an impediment to interoperability. Is that at all a worry?
Oh, I think it could be feasibly, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I think right now, like, you know, a lot of folks are either doing 1.0 or 1.3, and that 1.3 has been around for a little bit. So I think we're pretty okay there. And I think the other thing to think about is, you know, it's not like I could be running, you know, OpenFlow 1.3 and working with one vendor in one part of my network, and I could have a different version running another part of the network. It's not like I turn on OpenFlow and I turn on SDN and I have to do it for my entire network completely network-wide. Again, I'm picking off certain areas and I can have multiple controllers controlling different portions of the network. So, So I don't think it's as much of a concern.
Well, Jeff, I have to say that having you on Interop Radio has been worth the wait. We really appreciate you taking time. And I know that your day is about to get a lot busier because in just about 20 minutes, we get the word that the expo floor has closed. That happens at 3 p.m. Pacific, and at about 3:01, things shift into high gear as we start tearing down the portion of InteropNet that deals with the expo floor. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Excellent. Thanks for staying persistent with making this happen.
And because I am confident that I would miss it once again, can you tell everyone who you work for?
Jeff Enters with HP's Technology Services Organization.
Technology Services Organization, real quickly, Jeff, is there a way that people can keep up with all of your thoughts, your ideas? Are you out there on the Tweety pipes? Are you doing various things? How can people keep up with you?
Yeah, I do tweet just a little bit, nothing too much, but it's at Jeff Enters. I'm also on LinkedIn, so Jeff Enters on LinkedIn. And then you can hit us at hp.com/SDN.
Outstanding. Jeff, thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
That was Jeff Enters of HP's Technology Services Organization. And we were very happy to have him with us. You know, we're down to the very last segment here at Interop Live, Interop Radio from the show floor. We will be right back with you in just a few seconds with our final guest, our final thoughts. Don't dare go away. And we're back here at Interop Radio, live from the expo floor here at Interop 2015. Now, we've had people from the conference at Interop here as guests. We've had a number of people from the NOC team, the Network Operations Center. We've had my fellow journalist on. And right now, we're going to have someone here who's one of our exhibitors on the show floor here at Interop 2015. We've got with us David Wigley, who is CEO of Content Keeper. David, welcome to Interop Radio.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Now, David, I have to admit, I have not really gotten a chance to visit many of our exhibitors on the show floor. They've kept me fairly well chained in here and in the studio. So can you tell us first a little bit about what Content Keeper is?
Yeah, Content Keeper is basically a multi-layered malware defense device. It includes pretty effective web filtering, which seems to be the basis of a lot of malware defense these days because most of the malware is coming through the web.
Well, now, are you looking at content that's going both in and out? Are you looking at both directions, or is your primary task keeping stuff, bad stuff, out?
We do look in both directions because you need to do that. There's a lot of networks out there today that are being hit by all sorts of bits of malware, and a lot of it walks in the door on USB sticks and other things as well. So you need to actually look in both directions. And you also need a multi-layered approach because one technology is not going to do it for you. The guys out there are too smart. They keep ducking and weaving. So the more layers of protection you've got, the better off you are.
Well, you know, you're talking about this, and it reminds me that especially in recent weeks, we've seen a number of well-known security experts say essentially you need to work from the assumption that your network has already been compromised, that's the only safe assumption to make. Do you think that's a fair statement?
In a lot of cases, that's absolutely correct. There's so much malware out there that most devices on the planet have probably got something resident on their device. Whether it's going to cause you any damage or not depends on the security bits and pieces you've got in place. So to protect against that, it's actually a lot easier than most people think, because there's a few very easy steps you can take to give you probably about 95-98% protection against that malware. The problem is that most people don't bother doing it. So it makes it really easy for the hacking guys just to walk in the door. And, you know, web filtering is highly underrated, but because most of the stuff's through the web, actually it's really easy. If you block the outward going connection to those malware sites, then you've got no payload. If you've got no payload, you've got no problem. We do that very well with our product. And the other thing, of course, is mobile devices. Everyone's into BYOD, and so they're not necessarily on your network anyway. They might be, you know, down at Starbucks or at McDonald's or roaming around the countryside at airports or whatever. You've got to protect those devices as well, because most of them are piped back into your network. So it's another great area for a bit of malware to come sort of sneaking back in again.
Now, when you're talking about protecting against things going out, especially through web stuff, I can't believe that it's as easy as just blocking outbound port 80. Are you actually looking inside all the packets to see what's going on there?
Absolutely. And most organizations can't just block port 80 because they've got to use the internet. So you might as well unplug it if you're going to do that. Yes, our device is a little bit different from the rest of them out there because we're a transparent Ethernet bridge. We actually do everything at layer 2, which means that we're looking at every packet that goes through your network as it goes to the internet. That puts us in a really powerful position to inspect basically everything that's going on, all the files going in and out, all the web transactions that are going backwards and forwards, the web applications, all that sort of thing. We can look in and allow organizations to manage that with different policies, different people and so on.
Now, with the way that your device works, are you a bump on the wire so that everything goes through and you're actually doing the blocking, or are you interacting with switches and other devices that are already in line in order to perform the blocking mechanisms?
No, we are a bump in the wire. The device is totally transparent to anything else you have on the network. And in fact, the other devices won't even know that we're there. Which means that we can do things at very, very high speed. You know, for instance, we've got networks that we're filtering that are traveling up to 14 gigabits per second, and we're doing that on 4 1RU rack mount units, which I think is pretty phenomenal. I don't know anyone else who's doing that. The other thing you've got to do is, because Google and these other guys are all encrypting sessions for search engines and so on, that puts a lot of network protection devices really out of action because they can't see the data going through the pipe. So a lot of organizations have got to decrypt that traffic to be able to inspect it properly. And we're doing that at high speed and finding quite a bit of malware in that in those pipes that are encrypted going out to the internet. Of course, they want to hide, so they're going to do that. They're going to duck and weave in there. So you need a device that can actually decrypt today to be on the to give yourself a chance, that's for sure.
David, one thing that was brought up several times in sessions I was at was a CIO and sometimes a CEO saying you can't possibly spend too much on security, that there's no such thing. So you have to draw, let's say, an arbitrary or an artificial line of where you're willing to draw that line to spend on security. Do you have any sort of advice on how a CIO, CEO, risk management, risk compliance person, how do they figure out where to draw that line on security spend?
Well, it really depends on the type of organization you are and what sort of target you are, or even if not a target. You know, just work out how much money it would cost you, mainly in wages and salaries, if you have an outage. You know, for instance, if your site is hit by CryptoLocker, which a lot of sites have been devastated by recently, just add up the hours of time that your employees are going to spend cleaning that up, and pretty soon you'll get to a very large number. If you don't want to take that risk, then basically it's worth spending a lesser amount on some good quality malware protection sort of products, and there's some pretty good stuff out there. Won't give you 100% protection, but I'll tell you what, it gets pretty close to it, and that means you're going to have a lot less incidences, you know, as you go forward.
Right. I think the CEO's biggest fear is that they spend that money and that 1% comes true, where they've spent all the security money and they still got the breach. Is there anything you'd say to them about that?
If they hadn't spent the money, they would have more breaches more often. That's for sure. I mean, to a certain extent, the security industry has been sort of called the biggest ambulance-chasing industry on the planet, and there is some truth in that. So, but what people have got to look out for in their solutions is, that they've got both, the traditional signature-based checking solutions that are out there, namely antivirus, and you should have that on your gateway and in your end devices, plus something to deal with, these new attacks, the ones they call them polymorphic, which is where every instance of the malware that's put out there is actually different. And because it's different, of course, the old signature checking stuff's not working anymore because it's a different signature. So you need something that's proactive, and that leads you into, behavioral analysis techniques and also into sandboxing techniques that you need on top of, data leakage protection and some sort of threat isolation. One of the big problems is out there that when a box gets infected, it's talking out to botnets and malware hosts on the internet. Nobody knows about it. You're better off having a device that can go, okay, I know that guy's talking to these malware hosts and I know he's going to download something. Let's cut him off from the internet. And you've got to do that. You've basically got to firewall them off from the internet because it might start on the web. It might come in over the web and then it goes out on some proprietary encryption sort of on different port numbers and all the rest of it. So cut them off, clean it up, and start again.
I kind of like that. A good three-step piece of advice for people dealing with the malware.
Yeah.
Well, David, I'd like to change directions just a little bit. We're coming down to the very end of the program here, and you've been here as a vendor at Interop 2015. How has your experience been? Have you enjoyed it? Have you met people that you've wanted to meet or met people out of complete serendipity that you're glad you met?
Absolutely. We've found the show to be, it's been fantastic. We've met a lot of people and you talk to them and once you sort of explain what you're doing, there's a lot of excitement out there. So we've had quite a bit of a crowd on our stand and we've got a hell of a lot of leads to follow up on next week. So yeah, it's been a major success for us and we're very glad we came. This is our first Interop for many, many years and it's been a good one.
Outstanding. Always glad to hear that from someone. Actually glad to hear it, whether they're an exhibitor or an attendee. Very pleased to hear when people have good experiences and fortunately it's not a rare thing to hear, so we're really pleased. Well, David, we're also pleased that you were here to be our final guest live from the expo floor at Interop 2015. We appreciate you taking the time out before you get to the hard work of sorting through those leads and making all the follow-up calls that have to be made. And we look forward to having you as a guest again in the future here on Interop Radio.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And if anyone's interested in what Content Keeper Technologies has got to offer, please just have a look at our website. It's just www.contentkeeper.com.
Also, we always ask people, do you as the CEO, are you out there on the Tweety Pipes? Do you do any sort of social media thing or blogging yourself?
We do, yeah, absolutely. So we're out there on Twitter and Facebook and so on, and that all helps spread the message.
Mm. Outstanding. Well, David, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was David Wigley, CEO of Content Keeper, one of the exhibiting companies here at Interop 2015, one of the companies out there on the expo floor. We appreciate him taking the time to be with us. And he was, as I said, our final guest from outside the staff. Now, I'm still sitting here with my colleague and friend David Wagner. David, we have heard a lot of people here at Interop. I'm curious, what are your thoughts as we get to wrap things up here on Interop Radio?
Well, I think my number one thought is that I've had a lot of fun here. And I've met a lot of people here. If you haven't come here before, you need to come. And if you've come here before but you didn't come this year, you need to come back. I've had just a number of amazing conversations with people, and I'm already looking forward to next year.
Looking forward to next year is something that I'm doing as well. In addition, you know, for me, this has been a great interop. I've been around the interop net and the NOC here at interop for a long time, more than a decade. This was really a year when I upped my presence here. I went to Hot Stage for the first time. And I think we've really been able to bring a lot of the interop net and SDN lab experience to people through the radio. And I'm looking forward to doing more of that, both at next year's interop and between now and then, because I think it's important to let people know that interop radio isn't ending tomorrow with the show that you're going to be hosting, because I'm going to be on an airplane. We're going to take a week off to let our voices recover. And then, starting in a couple of weeks, Interop Radio will be back bringing you the same kind of information about networking, security, enterprise computing, all those things that Interop is famous for. You know, the community just keeps going. And, Dave, I'm looking forward to you being part of that.
Yeah, well, and I just want to say, too, Interop doesn't end today either. Interop is a whole year commitment as well. It's a community. Tomorrow, I'm going to go through all the business cards I collected. I'm going to send out a lot of email. I'm going to get a lot of email. I'm going to form a lot of relationships. And then I'm going to come back here next year, and I'm going to strengthen those relationships in person again. So you're right, we need that week to take a breath and get our voices back. Looking forward to the show tomorrow. I have a little bit of voice left, and but then I'm gonna make sure that Interop is a whole year long relationship.
Well, we hope that you will be able to keep that relationship going, because you're part of the Interop community, and Interop really is all about the community. Many people have called what goes on here a gathering of the networking tribe. Some people have called the Interop Net Experience summer camp for geeks. I think all of that is true, but so much more is as well. Please be back with us again tomorrow and throughout the year. Let your colleagues and friends know about us, because we're going to be here on Interop Radio. We're going to be doing a lot of great things. I'm looking forward to telling you about all of those in weeks to come. Well, for Dave Wagner, for all of our guests, for everyone here at Interop 2015, I'm Kurt Franklin. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll see you way before next year, but plan to be back with Dave tomorrow. See you soon.